Ah, the singing nun. Remember her? Matter of fact, they used that song in American Horror Story on television. Strange. Ed Haslam with us. We're talking about his work, Dr. Mary's Monkey, how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing monkey viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald's assassination and emerging global epidemics. It's an amazing story. We'll have more and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast this hour. Ed Haslam is with us. We'll take calls as well. Ed, are you convinced that the plot to kill John F. Kennedy originated in New Orleans?
No, because I think it originated in Texas and Washington, D.C., and there were just some part of it was in New Orleans, but it obviously involves very high level people in intelligence and the American power structure, and some of which are in New Orleans, but not everybody there. I think they were using. I mean, you got to have some crazies if you're going to set this thing up, because you don't know what's going to go wrong, and you got to have people to blame and stuff. But there was real stuff going on in New Orleans, and you know John Barber. John's career was ruined because he agreed to put Jim Garrison on the radio in Los Angeles. And he was the number one TV producer in America at the time, and he couldn't get anybody to return his phone calls after that. But let me make sure that I close this issue about Oswald flushing the toilets. What were they flushing? They were flushing the stuff from the test tubes from the bioweapon experiment, because they had to get it out of Mary Sherman's apartment, and that is why they were flushing the toilet over and over and over again, because they were disposing the sauce that was all full of the cancer-causing viruses.
Was Mary that brilliant to be able to work on this?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody that knew Mary, I mean, Mary counted amongst her personal friends people like Enrico Fermi, the father of
That's
the
good.
atomic bomb.
Who paid her salary, Ed?
Well, she worked for Alton Ochsner at the Ochsner Clinic. She ran a cancer lab there. She was a practicing orthopedic surgeon, and I'm quite sure that she was being paid extra for her work for the CIA, But it's, she was a successful woman. I mean, she wasn't like David Ferry, who's, kind of a loose cannon. You didn't know where his next meal or clothes were coming from. Mary was very successful, very widely published in the cancer journals and the radiation journals, and my father, who came out of Harvard Medical School, just had the utmost respect for her professionally, just said she was at the absolute top of her game.
Was she well known at the time?
Within the circles of, I mean, she wasn't on Dancing with the Stars, but within the circles of medicine, she was internationally known.
Do you think she knew about the killers of John F. Kennedy?
Well, she expressed her concern that, particularly on this biological weapon thing, that Ochsner thought he could control the use of this thing, and she didn't think he could really control these people. And she had several discussions with David Ferry and Judy in the room, which said that they were concerned that if they didn't get Castro killed by a certain time, that these people would go after Kennedy. And so I think she knew quite a bit about it, and she certainly knew who Oswald was. And one of the things I have is a memo from J. Edgar Hoover telling his agents not to investigate her murder.
Like to back off?
Under threat of reprimand. This is a local murder, and your agents are, I mean, this was in a memo from Hoover to the head of the FBI office in New Orleans, and said, "Do not investigate this murder. We don't have any jurisdiction," was his rationale for it. But if you follow my thing that she was actually maimed and had her arm burned off and was subsequently killed on federal property at the U.S. Public Health Service, that is federal jurisdiction.
Before we take final calls here for you, what did the CIA really know and refuse to tell us even to this day.
Well, you got this a family jewels document, which I find is very interesting.
Explain that.
During the Watergate thing, there was something that went on where the director of the CIA shut off his mouth and said something that was wrong. And one of his staff said, you know, boss, you know, you're talking about stuff you don't know about. So the director of the CIA ordered the head of his security to find out all the things that the CIA had done that was either illegal or embarrassing to the CIA and put it in an eyes-only memo and review it with the top brass at the CIA. This document, the CIA's name for this document was the family jewels, okay? And in 2007, the very month I released my book, the Michael Hayden, the head of the CIA, held a press conference and said, time to open the kimono. We're going to tell you all the nasty stuff the CIA did between 1958 and 1964 by revealing this family jewels document. Well, there were eight jewels in there. Number two on the list was killing, using the mafia to kill Fidel Castro. That was number two. Okay, they tell us what number two, three, four, five, six, seven, and eight are, but they do not tell us what jewel number one is. Jewel number one is 100% redacted. I mean, that's three pages of solid redaction, not a single word, okay? So when we know that the CIA is unwilling to tell us a single word about an operation that happened at the exact same time I'm talking about, 50 years later, then how can I answer that question? You know, if they would tell us what they really did, I could answer your question. And I think family jewel number one is the CIA using their money laundering operation to set up this Medical Manhattan Project because they know about the cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine, which is why we have an epidemic of cancer today.
Is all this still ongoing? These clandestine things that they do?
Well, I'm going to let others answer that question. You know, I try to stick to the thing that I know about, and that's this period of time. And there's so much. I don't see why they would clean up their act. You know, I mean, Snowden opens tomorrow. You know, I mean, all kind of stuff is going on. You know, and we don't know what it is. I mean, how could they be spying on everybody in the United States and nobody says anything? You know, we kill 100,000 people in Iraq, you know, and put the guy who says we did it in jail, you know.
Let's take some calls for you. Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Sherry, get us started here. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hello, sir. I wanted to know, who was totally behind the Kennedy assassination? Was it the military-industrial complex? I mean, I'm not asking you to name names, and or Johnson, and or was Hoover involved, and or who?
Interesting question for you, Ed. We've all got our own thoughts. Go ahead.
I wasn't there, but I do think that the Texas money and power people, including Lyndon Johnson, were privy to setting it up. I do think it came out of the military-industrial complex. That's an awfully big expression, but it does mean include things like the CIA. And it's very easy for those people to use the mafia. I think the mafia supplied some of the shooters, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They may have imported them from outside the country.
Well, Chauncey Holt, who was, you know, part of Mongoose and Meyer Lansky's guy, said he drove two mafia hit guys from Peter Licavoli's ranch in Arizona to Dallas that morning, and he had in his hand the fake Secret Service IDs that were he passed out in Daley Plaza. You know, that's pretty clear mafia involvement.
Well, and one of the things I think, Bobby Kennedy going after the mob sure didn't help things.
No, it didn't, and that's part of the... I mean, I personally think that Oswald was brought back into the United States by Bobby Kennedy, okay?
Whoa, tell me about that.
Well, the question is, did Oswald defect or not? Okay? And there is one person in the United States government, one officer in the government that has the power to say whether you have lost your citizenship or not. And that person is the Attorney General. Okay? And at the time Oswald returned to the United States, the Attorney General was Bobby Kennedy. Okay? And so I think he basically cut a deal with Oswald to get him back in the country so that Oswald would spy on the mafia and all this stuff for him. And when you look at, you know, you say, all right, we're going to go shoot President Kennedy through the head with high-powered rifles in broad daylight. You know, we got to blame it on somebody. Well, if we blame it on a guy working for Bobby Kennedy, Kennedy can't come after us. I mean, you've got to control the Attorney General at the time of the assassination, which is why I think Bobby Kennedy did not respond properly by sending his federal marshals down and getting his hands on Oswald ASAP, because Oswald would have, he needed to be protected.
Now, are you speculating that Oswald worked with Bobby Kennedy, or do you have some proof here?
Well, this is my analysis of what I have seen out there and read. And you know, there is not a memo there, but if you trace the people, I heard this originally in New Orleans in 1964, and I didn't understand it, but I was told it by a woman who had sons that were judges and stuff, and was hearing what was going on in the Warren Report background and stuff. And I didn't understand it, but when I finally started looking into it, I said, now, hey, this is something that starts to make sense, because it starts to explain things like why Bobby choked at the time and J. Edgar Hoover's whole thing of grabbing Oswald immediately. You know, Hoover shut down the investigation an hour and a half after Kennedy was killed. You know, he said, we got our man, just wrap it up, and I don't want to hear anything other than Oswald did it, you know. So am I speculating? Yes. Do I speculate? Yes. You know, but that's my analysis. I mean, if you want to know what I think about this after 20 years of doing it, that's where I think the big issue lies.
Now, who was this guy who went to Mexico to try to get a visa to travel to Cuba and the Soviet Union that they said was Lee Harvey Oswald? The pictures were all over the place then, and the guy doesn't look anything like him.
Well, the guy they photographed was not Oswald, you know, and there's a lot of stuff about that. Oswald apparently went down there to deliver the biological weapon, but I personally think, and if you do a careful reading of me and Lee, about September 25th, which is the day Lee goes from New Orleans to Mexico City, you'll see that he gets swindled out of the biological weapon by these people in Texas, and he's given a fresh bunch of what he's told is biological weapon. I think it's chicken soup, and he goes down there, okay, but everything falls apart for him down there because his contacts aren't there and all that. But if you want detail on that, you know, I would say me and Lee is probably the best thing. I've been saying for years I didn't think they had a single hard piece of evidence that said he was actually in Mexico City, but sometimes you don't have hard pieces of evidence to back stuff up, you know.
Next up, we go to Jeff in Culver City, California. Good morning, Jeff. Good to have you with us, I think. Jeff, you there? Nope, he's gone. Let's try Jason in Farmington, Missouri. Hey, Jason, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Seth. Hey, George, I just come back from Daly Plaza. I was down there in July, and they've been doing some strange things down there. Like they moved the sign, the Simmons Drive sign down. They've taken it down.
Why?
I don't know. And they've also, you remember the drain pipe that there's supposedly, there's a theory out there that there was somebody down that drain.
Right, right.
You've heard that. They moved that drain down now about 10 feet. And they've just been changing little things. And I was all around. I was all up on the grassy knoll, and I went behind the picket fence. Anyway.
See, I don't think they should be touching anything.
I don't either. Yeah. And you know, that's for us to go see, you know.
Yep.
Well, if you go up to the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, they have the, quote, sniper's nest glassed off. So you cannot go to the window and look out the window and see that the shot doesn't make any sense.
Can you even see the area?
Yeah, I mean,
there?
It's part of the museum. And they got a statue of somebody supposed to be Oswald with a rifle in his hand looking out of the window. But you cannot go over to the window and look out the window to notice the trees in the way and stuff.
Do they have a statue by the grassy knoll?
No, they don't. And one of the whole reasons they have the sixth floor museum is to keep your attention on the sixth floor. If you're going to shoot somebody in a moving vehicle, you need to be right behind them. And right behind the vehicle is the third floor of the Daltex building.
We go next to our first-time caller, Mark in Arizona. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Ed. I'm the reporter for Dr. Scott here in Arizona.
Oh, great. A good guy.
He sends his regards to you, George.
Thank you, Mark.
I had a question, and me and my wife just got back from the Snowden movie premiere.
Good.
And I do have a Band-Aid on my picture on my phone, so they can't see me. tomorrow's Oliver Stone's 75th birthday, and he did a great movie about JFK. Some of the facts weren't accurate, but my question for Ed, and I've read Me and Lee, that book too, and David Sherry's book, and your book, of course, was the first one just recently, and need to come to Phoenix to give a talk, Ed, but my question is the polio vaccine that they injected into people. Could you tell us more about that, and could you also mention how that has affected, why it took so long for it to generate itself after 30 years, about the NIH and the American Cancer Society, why they came about?
And that vaccine had the simian monkey virus in it, which is not good.
Well, both of the polio vaccines, talking about the Salk and Sabin vaccines released between 1955 and 1963, were grown on monkey kidney cells. And so when they ground up the monkey kidneys to grow the polio virus to make the vaccines, they got all of the other viruses that were in the monkey's kidneys in the vaccine. And after they had released 100 million doses of that, they realized that one of the viruses they found in the vaccine, called SV40, was actually a cancer-causing virus.
I've got that, injection in me. I was a baby of the 50s. That happened.
And so it was in both the Salk and Sabin vaccines. They injected the Salk vaccine with a needle, and they injected the first round of the Sabin vaccines, which means it goes straight into your blood supply without going through your intestines.
We're going to come back in a moment, Ed, and take final phone calls with you. Fast night, and then later on tonight in the show, we've got open lines for you with a little topic. So make sure you're part of the program. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. Our final segment with Ed Haslam, as we will take your calls as quickly as we can. Ed, for Lee Harvey Oswald, he was 22 to 24 years old. He was 24 when he died. This guy was pretty young to do all these things, wasn't
That's he? Right. He was 23 during this 5 months in New Orleans. And one of the things I wanted to point to, which is a pretty bizarre thing that nobody has really understood up to now, was on July 25th, Lee Oswald walked into the Atomic Energy Museum in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and signed the register. And he didn't just sign it, Lee H. Oswald. He wrote the letters USSR over his name, like, pay attention, FBI. And even though he lived in New Orleans at the time, he put his address down as Dallas Road, Dallas, Texas. Well, there is no Dallas Road in Dallas, Texas. Lee was trying to tell somebody something there. And then he comes back to New Orleans. They have that raid on the training camp. All these people from Mongoose show up. He gets in the street fight in August 9th. And then on August 16th, he's standing out in front of the International Trade Mart, handing out Fair Play for Cuba leaflets.
And I remember seeing him on film.
Right, and he was filmed by WDSU television. Now, what's interesting is he did not actually start handing out the leaflets until the camera showed up, which means this idea that they were called because he was leafleting is wrong. This whole thing was a setup so that he would be caught on film handing these things out in support of his pro-communist persona that they were trying to create on.
Right, and they did a great job doing that.
That's right. And in those photos, there are six still photos which were taken from the cameraman's film. And in those photos, we see about 10 different guys in there, most of which we can name, okay? And the point of that I need to get to here is this was 1 week after he was in the street fight on Canal Street, which was a staged incident also, which I could prove if we had time. But the point is, he got spooked by that thing could have gotten out of hand and he could have gotten beaten up really badly. All right, he happened to be saved by the New Orleans police that day. But he didn't want to get into a fight on this other day, and there is no place in New Orleans that would be, I mean, this is like holding a Christian demonstration in front of a mosque, you know? I mean, it's the exact wrong place to do this, okay? And so he asked to have some backup. So he needed somebody who was a Cuban, who spoke Spanish, and who could watch his back, and if angry Cubans showed up, that could stand out and talk to him and say, no, he's all right, don't beat him up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And when this thing of Rafael Cruz came up, I mean, I was watching Wayne Madsen talk on the internet, and Wayne said, we've got Rafael Cruz in New Orleans. Well, Rafael Cruz is a Cuban. He was in the United States as a political asylum. He was an active demonstrator. I mean, when he even worked for Castro, throwing Molotov cocktails and stuff against Batista down there. He was a street fighter, okay? And so he comes to the United States, and he goes to University of Texas, gets a degree in petroleum engineering, and starts working in New Orleans. He starts a company and eventually sells the company to the Schlumberger Tool Company, right, which is in the oil exploration.
And how did he do on the sale? Pretty good?
I don't know the details of it, but Schlumberger is Halliburton's big brother.
Ah,
okay,
that's right.
The biggest
right.
oil field exploration people in the world. All right? And so when this thing came up, I called my publisher. I said, do you know anything about this? He said, look at the photos. And I looked at the photos, and I found some pictures of Rafael Cruz, both as a teenager and modern day. And I did a comparison, put them together. And in my opinion, and I got a pretty good eye. I've got a degree in art history, and I used to be a photographer. This is the same guy, okay? And then Judith Vary Baker says, well, you know, I was there that day with Lee in front of the ITM, and this guy that Lee told me his name was Raffaello came and he walked no more than 6 feet from me, and he was there to watch Lee's back, which is what Lee told Judy. And then a couple of days later, Lee and Judy were walking in Lafayette Park near Bannister's office, and Rafael comes walking across the park there, and Lee says, that's Archangel Rafael over there, you know, and going into Bannister's office. And so while Lee never used his last name, Cruz, he did refer to this person identified in the photo as Rafael Cruz, as Raffaello, and told that to Judith on two occasions. And so what I saw in the horrible media response, everyone saying, oh, ridiculous and, you know, unfounded and everything else. Well, wait a second. Who do you think it's going to be with Oswald in a thing about Cuba? It's going to be Cubans, right? And so the whole context of this thing fits very nicely. I mean, they even had a reporter from Fort Worth trying to debunk it. I looked up the reporter, and his background was reporting on high school football games. His way of identifying somebody was to read the number on the shirt and look them up on the list. You know, he had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. You know, so the Rafael Cruz thing, and the big point on the Rafael Cruz thing was when this happened, I said, well, what does Rafael Cruz have to say about it? I mean, all he has to do is call a press conference and deny it. Nope, didn't do it.
No denial. Let's no take denial. Some final calls for you.
And that week, it was Ted said, I'm in this to the finish, and then all of a sudden Ted drops out.
John in Los Angeles, welcome to the show, John. Hi there.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Norrie, and your guest.
Thank you, sir.
It's fascinating. The hospital in New Orleans, there would have been ample evidence showing that they would have been able to put a collider in down there, because it would have had to have been increased in power tremendously to create that collider to mix the biologicals together.
Absolutely. Which is how we found the building. Okay.
Okay. That explains it then. You were able to chase back what they were history to get it to it.
Yeah, they took the linear particle accelerator out, but they left all the wiring that was required for it in there. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And they even had a steel wall that was grounded to protect the operators from the radiation and stuff in there. And if you go to that, and I think this is still true today. I mean, it's certainly been true for the last 20 years. If you go to that facility, there's about 13 buildings on this rather large campus, right, including a great big hospital. On the back of the campus, they have some smaller buildings. Everything on that campus has been totally renovated, remodeled, is in good condition, except for this one building where the roof is falling in and they got the orange fence around it, and nobody wants to go in it because it's full of asbestos, and it was called the Infectious Disease Laboratory. That is the building that had the strange wiring in it. And that's where we think the, in fact, I'm sure, where the linear particle accelerator was.
What has happened to all of this stuff now?
Well, the federal government sold it to the state of Louisiana, the whole complex, for $1. And it became a adolescent care facility. And then it merged with the Children's Hospital, which was right across the street, who now controls it. And my father, ironically, was president of the Children's Hospital.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah. So all that stuff is now part of that children's and adolescent care complex. It used to be, it was built during World War One, right on the river so that they could take wounded soldiers off of the ships and put them into a hospital. And that's the history of the place. So it's all a bunch of old brick buildings, federal style.
Let's go to our first-time caller, Brian in Glen Ellen, Illinois. Hey, Brian, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Oh, and Ed, I'd like to thank you for your bravery and always committing to the truth here.
You're welcome.
Anyway, my question is this. There's an old 40-year-old document called the Gemstone File, and you piqued my interest when you started talking about the CIA document called the Family Jewels, and I was wondering if there's any relation between the two.
I'm not familiar enough with the Gemstone Files, and I've seen it referred to in the literature, but I haven't really looked at it and done a close analysis of it like I did on the Family Jewels. So, you know, I can't answer the question properly, but I can tell you the stuff they did, they don't want to tell us about.
There are so many hidden things and facets of what's going on these days. How do you keep track, Ed, of all this stuff?
I don't know. I mean, it's all in my head at this point. I, you know, when I was writing the book, I had to do a filing system just to keep track of all the documents and put it on my computer and all that other stuff. And it was like I had my own library, you know. But nowadays, particularly since stuff keeps coming in, drifting to me, you know, people bring me information now. And fortunately, you know, I have the perspective where I know where it fits, and I can do something about it. One of the most bizarre things I ran across was on July 25th, Lee Oswald walked into Oh, I told you this, the atomic energy.
Right. And this was what, 63?
This was 63, yeah. And it, the point is, he was in New Orleans on the July 24th and July 26th, and it's 650 miles from New Orleans to Knoxville, Tennessee, where Oak Ridge is. And you can't do that in a car. It has to be done in an airplane. And when you realize, and this is not the only evidence of this, but Oswald was being flown around in twin-engine airplanes by the CIA people. And when he went up to Knoxville, he told Judy he was getting more supplies for the project, which may be they needed more radioactive stuff. But there's also a machine gun company up there, Knoxville Arms, and he may have been up there picking up machine guns for this anti-Castro group. But it's pretty solid that the only way to do it is with an airplane.
Did he make any money, Ed? I thought Oswald was stone broke.
Well, that's a very interesting point, George, because he stops working at the Riley Coffee Company on July 19th, and it is 68 days before he goes to Mexico City, which isn't cheap, okay? So where's he getting his money from? He's being paid through the FBI as an FBI informant. He's being paid $400 a month, which is, a lot of, it's like $4,000 a month today. I mean, that's where he was getting his money from. And, that's why there's even the Warren Commission even slipped at one point and said he was an FBI informant.
Jeez. Even if he might have been the lone gunman, I don't think he was at all. But if he happened to be, do you think when this was revealed it was him, that these people who all knew him clandestinely were in shock?
Well, I don't know who you mean by all.
I mean the FBI people, the Secret Service, the CIA people, everybody who knew Oswald.
First of all, Oswald didn't shoot anybody.
No, I know that. I know that. I agree with you. But, I mean, just the fact that he was named, did they expect it?
I don't know. You have to ask them.
They're all dead now, Eddie.
Yes, I know, but you're asking me what they thought, and I can't tell you what they thought, but I can tell you that Oswald was in the lunchroom on the second floor, and he was not up on the sixth floor, and therefore he didn't shoot any, he certainly didn't shoot Kennedy. And then when you get out to the Tippit situation, he was already in the movie theater, and Tippit was shot with a semi-automatic, and they claim Oswald had a revolver on him, so nothing matches up with that. And, I think Lee was just framed, and he was supposed to be killed that day. He was never supposed to be arrested and brought back to the thing and have all the media attention and all that stuff. He was just supposed to be killed. But he knew that he was in a very dangerous situation.
He sure did. Let's go to Jim in Kansas City. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. Boy, like Pessy said in JFK, what a tangled web we weave.
Oh, yes.
But, Ed, my question to you is, the guy who is the director of the 6-4 Museum, I heard something in a documentary once. I'd want to know if you could comment on it, that he at one time, like most of us, felt like he did not buy the lone gunman theory. But I hear now that his story just fits what the media wants to believe and what the government wants you to believe is that Lee Harvey did act alone. Did he change his thinking on that? Have you heard anything on that?
Well, he not only changed his thinking, but he changed his name, and now he's dead.
Wow.
But,
wow.
But what changed his Robert Groden was offered the position of director of the 6-4. Robert Groden's the guy that gave the Zapruder film to Geraldo, okay? He was offered $200,000 to be the director of the museum, and he wouldn't do it. Okay, this other guy took the money and changed his tune, is what it boils down to.
Why did he change his name?
He used to be on radio and had a name on radio, and then he changed it. And I mean, you'd have to ask him, but I do know, it's 3:00 in the morning where I am. I can't remember everything off the top of my head, but I do know what his original name was and what he changed it to. And he changed it to that name about the time he became director of the museum.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate it. You guys do a great job. George, Ed, thank you so much. Love the program.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it, too. We've got time for maybe one or two more calls. Jim in Delaware is with us now. Jim, go ahead.
Hey, George, I suspect Oswald knew his days were numbered after a while. But anyway, I have one question for Ed.
Okay.
What's the primary reason the conspirators wanted Master Jack killed?
We all have our thoughts on that, Ed, don't we?
Yeah, well, you'd have to ask the conspirators. I mean, I can give you a couple of reasons.
Mob, Cuba, all that.
You know, you had the racial stuff with him with the civil rights. You had the stuff with the banking system where he was trying to get us, you know, off of the Federal Reserve Bank, which was a big issue. You got the whole thing with Vietnam and him wanting to pull out of Vietnam instead of go into it. I mean, you know, and you got the nuclear test ban treaties.
You got the mob.
Yeah, the whole thing with the mob and his brother and all that. I mean, what you had is kind of a perfect storm of everyone saying, let's get rid of this idiot.
Absolutely. Ed, I want to thank you for being on the program again. I look forward to seeing you in October in New Orleans at that event. We've got it posted up under my events calendar at coasttocoastam.com. That's going to be intriguing.
Yeah, that's oswaldconference.com if anyone wants to look it up.
Great. Thanks again, Ed. I really appreciate it. I'm going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to have a couple hours of open lines for you, including this topic. Did you ever get close to dying? If you did, share that story with us, whatever it might have been. An accident, a hospital stay, you fell off a ladder. I want to hear that story. And was there any kind of intervention that may have saved you?